From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. We take for granted the ubiquitous presence of police in American society. Cops patrol our neighborhoods and our schools. They're called upon to deal with the homeless and the mentally ill. But barely a week passes by without reports of an unarmed person being killed by police. More often than not, the victim is a person of color, often African American. The crisis in policing has generated a much-needed debate about the role of policing. While most of the solutions being promoted center on the need for more diversity training or more body cameras, my guest makes the case that, quote, the problem is policing itself. Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. His writings about policing have appeared in the New York Times, New York Daily News, and USA Today, as well as The Nation and Vice News. He joins me to discuss his new book called simply The End of Policing. Welcome to the program, Alex.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So a big part of the problem that often stymies any research into the impacts of law enforcement is a lack of centralized data and comprehensive data on just what impact police have in society, right? How big a challenge is that to someone like yourself who researches this issue, but also to advocates who actually want to fix policing?
Well, it's a huge challenge. It takes a couple of different forms. One is that we have almost 18,000 separate police departments in the United States, and they all have their own policies, their own reporting regimes, their own training protocols. And then the second problem is that there's very little in the way of requirements around reporting that would allow us to collect this data in either a systematic or comprehensive kind of way. So we often, people ask, are shootings going up or shootings going down? We often just don't know the answer to that as a result.
Right. And so we certainly do rely then on anecdotal evidence, the news reports, the protests against police killings, and the conversations that movements like Black Lives Matter have been generating, which are so urgent and necessary. And under the Obama administration, when there was a lot of attention being paid to this issue, and when there was at least lip service being paid to wanting to improve policing, we did see this idea that body cameras, more use of dash cam videos, et cetera, would be one step towards improving policing. There was, of course, also a program the Justice Department oversaw and was investigating many individual departments. But broadly speaking, as far as you can tell, did any of the solutions promoted by the Obama administration on policing actually have a positive impact, as in reducing police violence, unnecessary police violence?
Well, certainly the number of shootings or killings has not gone down. We continue on a pace of around 1,000 a year. We know that because of efforts by independent journalists to try to collect this data, since we still can't get accurate reporting from the police themselves. And I don't think we have a lot to show for the last 4 or 5 years of crisis around policing and all these reforms. I think just the events of the last few weeks make it clear that the killings of unarmed African-American men continue, that relationships between communities of color and the police have not improved, and that these kinds of liberal reforms are not going to bring the kind of relief that these communities are really looking for.
What do you make of the fact that any time we have issues that involve the safety and security of Americans, police tend to be offered up as the answer? For example, right now there's a lot of discussion about shootings in schools. And often people say, well, if only we had more officers to shoot the shooters, or we've got a lot of problems with homelessness. Well, we need better resources for police. It tends to be that our sort of society's reliance on police as a solution, the police itself as a solution to so many social crises, is a knee-jerk reaction that doesn't seem to be based in evidence of it actually working.
Well, we've really entered into a long-term bipartisan consensus around the idea that police are the primary tool for producing public safety. And of course, it doesn't have to be that way. What we've really seen is a shifting in the role of government away from the provision of kind of basic social welfare, a safety net, towards one of repressive social control to manage social problems. And of course, the nature of the problems have changed along with the sort of neoliberal economic reorganization of society that's produced things like mass homelessness, the defunding of schools and the privatization of schools and the use of charter schools and high-stakes testing. And then when those systems don't function well and kids get upset, bored, act out, instead of trying to fix the school, we bring in school police to try to restore order. And so that's just one example. But as you mentioned, you know, mass homelessness, untreated mental illness are contributing to social problems that have been produced in part by the state. And then the state, instead of resolving those problems, responds with heavy-handed policing.
Mm-hmm. And we even have, when there are incidents where police end up killing somebody when they were called upon because a person might have been worried about their mentally ill neighbor or loved one struggling and being a danger to themselves or others, police are called in, police end up killing them. Often the response is, well, the police need better training to deal with mentally ill folks. But what's the alternative to that? Isn't there a better alternative? I mean, should we even be calling the police in the case of somebody who's mentally ill? Is giving police more training on how to deal with mentally ill folks the solution?
Yeah, our approach to this is really largely off the rails. Here in New York, we just had another tragic police killing of an unarmed African-American male experiencing a mental health crisis. Now, I'm sure the shooting will be found legally justified, but the question is, why was this young person out on the streets, essentially homeless, coping with a completely untreated mental illness to the point that a crisis develops and the police get called? So the solution to this can't just be don't call the police.
Right.
That might have helped in Saheed's case. If they just hadn't called the police, he would be fine. But in many cases, these people are having a serious crisis, and there does need to be a response. The question is, why is it an armed police response? There are other places that don't do this, that understand that a mental health crisis is a health crisis, and trained health workers are sent. But there's a bigger problem, which is because we lack any kind of decent quality mental health infrastructure, we have more crises. So a lot of the crises that police end up responding to wouldn't even exist in the first place if we had adequate mental health care treatment. So ultimately, I'm not interested in trying to, you know, fine-tune a police response through a lot of very expensive training programs that show limited success. Instead, I want some political accountability so that our local, state, and federal political officials start investing in creating adequate mental health care services.
And so whenever we do throw money at police departments to solve problems, first of all, that money could be better served in actually addressing the cause of those problems to begin with, right? And then when we do that, don't we essentially accept that life with the constant presence, the omnipresence of police is somehow normal?
Yes, absolutely. I think what we need to be looking at are examples like what the Youth Justice Coalition has been doing in Los Angeles. They did some research and found that LA County was spending $10 billion a year on police and jails. And they said, if we could just redirect 5% of that money, we could fund all kinds of services for young people that would help break the cycle of violence and problematic behavior and school failure you know, we could put in summer jobs, we could put in community-based anti-violence efforts, we could put in more counselors in schools, but instead we spend all that money on police and jails.
There's also, I want to go back to the issue of homelessness that we were talking about earlier. I mean, that seems to be such an answer that is complex, because often issues of homelessness are intertwined with issues of mental illness, but they're also deeply intertwined with issues of employment and the economy, the kind of jobs that are out there, the cost of housing, lots of social programs that, if better funded, would actually go a long way towards reducing homelessness and actually housing people who need homes. Why is it, you think, that politicians have so easily fallen into this trap, as you said, the bipartisan approach to policing being the answer of everything? Why is it such a tempting answer for them?
Well, I think because we have this bipartisan consensus around austerity politics, especially at the, you know, at all levels really of government, even in our most progressive cities with our most progressive mayors, there's been a kind of an understanding that the state can't intervene directly in housing or employment markets anymore. We've got to break the city unions, push down wages, sell off public housing, and let the market settle these things. And that, of course, is what's producing mass homelessness and a lot of the other problems that we're seeing. So they're so committed to this idea that that it's not legitimate for the state to intervene in markets, that they have come to define all of our social problems as being the result of individual or group moral failure that will only respond to punitive mechanisms of social control, like heavy-handed policing. And of course, this extends to how our schools operate, how our social welfare systems operate, probation, parole. They've all become increasingly punitive. And it is that mindset that we're going to have to break, and the politics around it, if we're ever going to get real relief for people.
I'm so glad you've sort of framed this discussion on policing within the neoliberal economic model that's constantly promoted, because I feel like that's been one of the missing issues. So this idea that social programs need to be fully funded is unfortunately no longer considered a standard progressive answer among politicians. But there are grassroots groups that keep pushing this. And as you pointed out, for example, the Youth Justice Coalition here in LA, where we're located, is one great organization that is pushing these. But what are some models that around the country where the need for police has been reduced because many of the causes of the problems that we throw police at are actually being addressed?
Well, I don't think we have examples of where it's happened. What we have are examples of people who are developing struggles that move in that direction, and of programs at a smaller scale that are attempting to do these things. So there are places where schools are trying to adopt restorative justice practices so that they don't have to rely on school police. There are places like Minneapolis that are developing comprehensive plans to reduce youth violence without relying on police. Places like Ithaca, New York, that's trying to develop a strategy to address the harms associated with drug use without relying on police. But all of these plans are either in development or in partial implementation, and the police remain a major factor in most of them. So we have a lot more work to do. I will say that there is a kind of growing political space to have these kinds of conversations, to talk about bringing back a robust social safety net, social welfare net. I'll be speaking with DSA groups in Los Angeles and other cities over the next few months to try to think about how to put a kind of abolitionist politics into place that embraces a larger social justice agenda.
And we'll post a link to the events that you'll be at in LA later on our website. Now, we didn't bring up a couple of issues that I'd like to address that are sort of unique to our moment right now, which is one, which is we have a very, very overtly pro-police administration in the White House today. Donald Trump has wholeheartedly embraced police. In public, encouraged them to rough up suspects. Jeff Sessions comes from that tradition of, you know, racist moralizing of people that have traditionally been criminalized. So that's one issue. The other issue is the massive explosion of a new kind of addiction through opioids, and we have this massive opioid epidemic, which has been criminalized and not. It's sort of the Trump administration seems to flip back and forth between whether it wants to see opioid users as criminal or not. How do you hope these conversations on policing progress within the current political moment that we have today?
I think the real danger is that in response to Trump, that we romanticize what happened under the Obama administration. But really, those are just two flip sides of a kind of pro-police agenda. So on the one hand, you have Trump, who's engaged in a kind of thin blue line politics that overtly celebrates the expansion of police power, and that power should be as unregulated as possible, and that it should be applied in a growing number of circumstances. And on the other hand, you have a kind of liberal reform mindset that accepts the basic parameters of policing, the basic missions of policing, but attempts to get that policing to be friendlier, more procedurally just, less biased. But it doesn't change the fact that there's a widespread war on drugs, that there's criminalization of homelessness, that our schools are filled with police. So we should not be celebrating people like James Comey or the head of the DEA because they stand up to Trump in some way, because these folks are also deeply embedded in a mindset that says that we can solve our social problems through policing and prisons. So we really need a much broader rejection of this kind of punitive police-centered approach to government.
Finally, Alex, unfortunately, we have had a cultural shift as well over many decades, particularly perhaps in suburban areas, that have seen the police as, you know, absolutely necessary to keeping safety and security. I mean, we think of the white manager who called the cops on the two black customers at Starbucks, and this knee-jerk reliance on calling, you know, for every time we have a terrible police incident, it's often because someone has called the cops on someone else that they have criminalized in their minds. You know, we see cops showing up at block parties and city-sponsored events, cops running youth programs and collecting donations for the homeless. And the police have been, and policing has been integrated into our culture as this force for social good in a way that belies what their real impact is. How much of a cultural shift away from that do we need? I mean, those of us who really pay attention to the cops are scared every time we see a cop, you know, drive by. I have a negative reaction. But most Americans, I think, don't have that reaction.
You know, I think part of the problem is that the politics of austerity have been so dominant for so long that people have largely given up on the possibility of the state providing for them in anything other than a punitive way through policing and prisons. And so folks who know that their community needs other things fall back on calling the police or asking for more police because the choice they're given is nothing or more police. And there is a lot of insecurity in American society right now at all levels, a lot of economic precarity and social uncertainty. And I think this breeds a desire to bring in some kind of authoritative force that can fix things. of course, the consequence of that is the criminalization of young people of color and a lot of unjustified killings. But I think Charles Blow, a columnist in the New York Times the other day, said it very clearly. Basically, American society accepts these killings as unfortunate but a necessary byproduct of a politics of law and order and a reliance on policing to keep us safe in its own terms. And we really have to break that mindset that the only way to produce safety is through these coercive mechanisms. And that means really getting down to some grassroots organizing in communities with a message about how to use political empowerment to produce safety in ways that don't write off 20% of the community to save 80% of the community. We need to be able to work on behalf of everybody in the community.
Alex, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. His writings on policing have appeared in the New York Times, New York Daily News, USA Today, The Nation, and Vice News. And we've been talking about his new book, The End of Policing. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find out about us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.